Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Whatever happened to traditional gender roles, where men earned the best grades and most of the money, and women stayed home to cook and clean and raise the kids? Having fought for their rights to suffrage, education, and employment, American women have continued to expand their achievements in recent decades so that today they are more likely to graduate from high school, college, and graduate school than men, and have fared better in the Great Recession than their fathers, brothers, and partners. In fact, more than 40% of U.S. households today have women as the primary breadwinners, and similar trends are being reported in Europe, Asia, Latin America, even the Middle East. So what are the challenges of these evolving roles for men and women, and do they leave us better off than our parents' and grandparents' generations? Hannah Rosen is senior editor at The Atlantic and a founder of Slate's XX Women's section. Her new book is called The End of Men and the Rise of Women. Hannah, welcome to Think.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
What does the state of hookup culture tell us about the ways men's and women's roles and expectations for their lives have changed?
Great. We're diving right into the most controversial part of the book.
You know what? You might as well start with sex if it's a book about sex.
Exactly. That's funny. Yes, it's true that this started as an economic argument for me, and then what I noticed pretty quickly in researching it is that how deeply it affected our intimate emotional lives and our marriages, and so that's why I chose to write about sex. And I think we mostly understand the hookup culture to be about victimizing women and about men ruling. And what I found in the research, the deepest research about the hookup culture showed, was that at some level women need the hookup culture. They perpetuate it because they're at their most successful in the college and post-college years, and they really don't want anything to derail their career. So even though they might suffer day-to-day, and I write about some of that in the book, you also see from the characters in the book that they, you know, are using the hookup culture in order to avoid getting entangled in long-term relationships that might slow them down before they've established themselves professionally.
It's interesting that it took 40 years after the so-called sexual revolution for this to happen.
Yeah, it's funny. The sexual revolution, because people mention that to me often, you know, they say, oh, I grew up in the 60s and 70s. You know, we certainly had free sex. We were much looser. And it's a very different quality now. Right now, it has less to do about liberation and fun than it does about planning and control. You know, so if you look at teenagers, for example, they're having sex later and later. You know, a lot of this is not about sexual looseness. It's about women making future decisions and thinking about their careers, even if it costs them some pain. I mean, I don't think any woman would say, like, the hookup culture is awesome. You know, most women take advantage of it for a couple of years and they think, ugh, this is awful. I really want a boyfriend. You know, it's not that it's perfect, but it is necessary for women's advancement. And so in the course of the book, you watch one of the characters start in this very swaggering, bravado, kind of trash-talking way. And then by the end of the chapter, she's getting engaged because, you know, she's been in this culture a long time, and now it's time for her to get married. And in fact, that's exactly what statistics show, that for college-educated women, you know, the hookup culture is strong, but also marriage is very strong. Those two things are equally true at this moment. So I couldn't quite tell you exactly how that picture fits together, except maybe in a trial by fire way. They seem to need to go through the hookup culture and then end up, you know, 10-some years later, in strong and stable marriages.
Well, it's not so different. I mean, I'm 41. It's not so different from the situation with young men 20 years ago.
Meaning what?
Meaning, you know, at some point they want to hook up, they want to avoid commitment, they want to focus on their careers and have fun, and then there comes a point where they are ready to settle down.
Exactly. I guess you could say it's that way. I mean, I still think, you know, the difference between men and women is that women are complaining a lot more as it's happening, you know? So they do tend to think, not as much, there isn't as much difference between men and women on this question as you'd think, on the question of, you know, did you want this hookup to turn into something more serious? There's definitely a gap between men and women, but it's not a huge gap. It's like a 10% gap when they are asked the question, you know, in your last hookup, did you want it to turn into something serious? You know, it turns out men do, but also, you know, women do a little bit more. So it is something like men, except that I do think women take the interim period a little harder.
And you found that young women overall have literally no interest in even entertaining a discussion about whether or not birth control is, in fact, their right.
Well, it's funny. It was very funny to me when birth control came up in the war on women in the presidential election, because it's so anachronistic and so improbable that we should be opening up the question of birth control that it could only be explained as a backlash against the rise of women. So the idea is, you know, whatever you think about it culturally, whatever your values are, the idea of women not being able to take birth control would take down, you know, most American families. I mean, the majority of American families are dependent on women's ambition and their success in the workforce. So the idea that, you know, they couldn't have free access to birth control is, it would be, you know, the economy would collapse. It's just a crazy idea.
So the other thing that's been really controversial about this work for you is simply the title, which is also the title of that piece you wrote in 2010 for The Atlantic, The End of Men. Talk a little bit about what that means to you exactly.
Sure. Let me tell you about how that title came about and then what it means to me. So I didn't write the title. I didn't see the title until the magazine was on the newsstands. And I used to say that all the time, sort of defensively. But over time, the title's really stuck to me and really become part of our idiom. And so I can't run away from the title. It is called The End of Men, and if you look at the book cover, it's sort of yellow and pink writing. It looks like a road sign. You know, it looks like you're planting a sign in this point in the debate, and then we can sort of rage around the sign. But emotionally, how I think of the title is something like The Queen is Dead, Long Live the Queen. I mean, that's sort of the end of a certain kind of man. I mean, that's not as catchy, but that's actually what I mean. So the end of one kind of man and the beginning of a new kind of man, which is probably a better kind of man. So that's, you know, that's actually what it means. You could call it The End of Macho might be a more appropriate title. Probably The Rise of Women would be better descriptively, but The End of Men is very provocative.
You write really poignantly about this small town in Alabama where there was a big, like a Russell clothing factory that was shuttered, and a lot of men who had the great breadwinning jobs are now watching their wives support the families. Tell us a little bit about that place, Alexander, Alabama?
Alexander City. That town, for me, really represented America. I mean, I chose it because it was relatively small, and so many adults were employed by this manufacturing company, this textile manufacturer. It was a prosperous town, so people were very middle class, you know, somewhat educated, varied from not college degree to sort of full college degree in engineering or textile. So I thought this is a fairly typical middle class American town. It's the kind of town people talk about in political speeches or in, you know, country music, and it was very patriarchal. So there was the family that owned the mill, were the, you know, they were the leaders of the town, and then beneath them were all the managers in the mill, very traditionally patriarchal. And then all of a sudden the mill left, as mills left in many parts of America, and, you know, things were, it was like a tornado hit the town. And so what happened after that is that the women, who would in no way describe themselves as feminist and still don't, you know, by necessity sort of rose up and started working, or, you know, continued to work, and thus became the main breadwinners in their families and the ones earning the steady paychecks. Whereas for men, it was very hard for them to adjust and figure out what to do and start again at the bottom when they'd been doing so well at the top. And so you see these relationships really scramble over the period of a decade, and how it changes how men and women view each other, and then also what it does to the next generation. So I thought by taking such a small microscope to a place, you could really see how these gender dynamics were really changing the way we live in America now.
And in terms of the struggle to sort of come to terms with these kinds of economic and social changes, one guy told you, look, it's not enough to simply have a job. It has to be a manly job.
Exactly. I mean, that's the kind of things that I think help me understand, you know, the poignant idea that men were stuck in some way, that they had this idea of what it means to be a man, what it means to earn a salary, how one can make a living. And, you know, for many men, that doesn't include being even a school teacher or a nurse or something like that. Those jobs are considered too feminine, or a receptionist. And so I feel like that's one thing that we as a society need to get over. We don't need to eliminate all manly virtues or tell men that they need to become women, but we do need to create a little bigger space for men to fill in the jobs that exist, be able to provide for their families, be able to be fathers and, you know, responsible domestic participants without any of us looking askance and thinking there's something wrong with them if they are in the playground at 3 p.m. on a Tuesday with their child.
Do you think it is ultimately misogyny that makes it still uncomfortable for men to embrace typically female jobs like nurse, like teacher, when it is not considered unfeminine for women to take on jobs that have historically been held by men, like doctor and engineer and scientist?
Well, you have just articulated the $100 million question, you know. Why is it that women have been more flexible over the century? Why is it that women have been able to so radically change the way they present themselves in the public sphere, moving from, you know, not being able to work at all to not being able to work while married? And, you know, each year they break those barriers, and then, you know, we have like a television character to model for us exactly how we should live out those characters, like, you know, Mary Tyler Moore and then Murphy Brown and then Sex and the City. And, you know, so it's like we have changed very rapidly, and a women's movement to support all of this change. Whereas for men, you realize they don't go into professions that are considered feminine. You know, they haven't changed very much. Sort of, they're very ambivalent about changing the ideas of manhood and what counts as a man. Even very progressive men are a little stuck around these questions and very ambivalent about it. And so I don't know why that is. I can only sort of define it and paint a picture of it and say that it's definitely true and that we really need to think about it. I'm sure it's some combination of biological wiring and cultural expectation, and I would fall more on the cultural expectation side than the biological wiring, but surely it's a combination of those two things.
You know, reading the book a couple of times as I was taking notes, I wrote down this idea that we have, I suppose, in the minds of many men, chipped away at what it means to be male if certain things that used to be the exclusive domain of men no longer are.
Right. And I guess men don't like that. I mean, that's the problem. We're still in a transition phase where men are resisting that. So I think even the progressive men I talk to in the book will say something like, look, I politically and theoretically, I believe in that man, say that stay-at-home dad. I really think he should exist. I think it's awesome that guy is staying home with his kids, but I can't bring myself to be that guy. Like, I'm still kind of stuck around that question. It still feels unmanly to me. So I think we really have to think hard about what can we preserve that's manly, you know, that's not dysfunctional and that's manly, you know. I think moving into new professions, that we should sort of let go of that one and allow men to move into new professions. Taking care of your children, we should let go of that one too and, you know, make ourselves think it's okay and manly for men to take care of their children and be more domestic, if only because women are working so hard these days. But I think certain elements of manliness, like working with your hands or being the protector figure or physical strength, you know, those things, we don't have to tell men that all those things are bad or bullyish or anything like that. Those things are fine. We can preserve those things.
And do we need to also hold them to account for not being more flexible in terms of taking new jobs? If an old industry falls away, at some point you have empathy for people, but at some point you say, you got to figure something out.
Yeah, I mean, I go back and forth on this question because I talk to men about it a lot, and then some days I think, oh, I wish we'd been more protectionist. You know, wouldn't have we been better off just keeping those factories here? You know, what did we gain from this whole thing? We've just, you know, robbed all these people of their identities so that we could have cereal that's 20 cents cheaper. You know, the whole thing seems absurd to me, you know. And other times I think, you know, we have to move them a little bit further along that scale. So what's replacing the manufacturing economy? Things like high-tech manufacturing. It's still manufacturing, still perfectly manly, but requires, you know, some amount of sophisticated education and understanding of technology. So that's one dignified out, or something they call the artisan economy, which is, you know, men working with their hands in specialized ways that cannot be reproduced, you know, in China or by a machine. So building, in the case of the men in Alabama I wrote about, you know, they build specialized docks or, you know, specialized structures for people in town, and they know the local wood well, and they know the economy, and they're savvy businessmen. And so that's another dignified out. You couldn't really scale that across the country, but people are thinking really hard about how to preserve these things without, you know, freaking men out and making them think we're just telling them to wear a skirt.
Hannah Rosin is my guest. She's senior editor at The Atlantic and founder of Slate's XX Women's section. We're talking about her new book, The End of Men and the Rise of Women. You can be part of the conversation by calling in now to 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a graduate education flexible enough to allow you to explore what matters most to you. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Hannah Rosen. She is a founder of Slate's women's section Double X and a senior editor at The Atlantic. She's also author of the new book, The End of Men and the Rise of Women. You can be part of our conversation by calling in to 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. Hannah, when you talk about something like a dignified out for this generation of men sort of caught in the middle of this really substantial change in our society, it strikes me that maybe this is simply one generation's problem, that you know, the boys who will become men in 20 years won't necessarily have to struggle so much, do you think, with the changing roles of men and women?
That's the hope. It really feels very transitional now, like some hurricane hit and then it's all coming down and we don't really know how it's going to land. So there's still points of discomfort, like we're uncomfortable with women who are too aggressive in positions of power. And so in the book, I address that and write about what we as women explicitly are supposed to do about that, and, you know, literally what we're supposed to do when we try and negotiate. And for men, there are the points of discomfort that you and I discussed, having to do with, you know, are men being too feminized, and what's the right kind of man I can be? So definitely it feels like a deep questioning moment that even young Americans are going through, but that will be figured out, you know, especially after this recession. Many young Americans have a different relationship with the workforce than their fathers did, just by necessity. You know, there aren't those lifetime stable jobs anyway. So men have been forced to rethink, you know, their relationship with breadwinning and the economy and the particular workplace. And so I think it's just going to happen naturally.
Breadwinning is another fascinating concept to consider, because there was a time when there was just the breadwinner, and it was always or almost always the dad, the man. And then there was this question of primary breadwinner, which is where we're sort of hung up now. I mean, at some point, do we not just, will we get to the point that whoever is the adult in the relationship will assume that he or she will earn half the bread?
It's funny. I talked to one of my chapters is about women in pharmacy school, because that's one of the professions that has been rapidly overtaken by women.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to look closely at you know, sort of what does that look like? What are the boyfriends and girlfriends? How do they talk in a situation like that? And I talked to this very young woman. She was one of the younger ones there, maybe 21 years old. And I was asking her what she, you know, thought about her future. And she said, oh, you know, about the breadwinner, whichever one plays the role at the time.
Hmm.
And it occurred to me that the idea of breadwinner as the man had been completely erased. That connection was no longer there for her. It was really like that was a role and anybody could play the role, which is not true for me. I'm the same age as you are, but, you know, I still, you know, I was fighting the feminist fight against man as the breadwinner, but I didn't think of it as cleanly belonging to anybody who wanted it in the way I think in the younger generation they do.
Talk a little bit about how marriage has changed, really according to social class in this country.
Yes, I explicitly divided my book and my sections on marriage into two different socioeconomic classes, because it's not merely that different things are happening with marriage in America, opposite things are happening. So marriage is becoming almost like a class luxury, like many other things in America. So for those who are college educated, marriages are stronger than ever. The divorce rate is as low as it's ever been. People define their marriages as very happy. And I think it's largely because women have been able to step into these new roles. So what you have is what I call the seesaw marriage, which means that anybody has a shot of satisfaction at any given point, theoretically. You know, nobody's trapped in any role in the way they have been historically. And so that has made for more happy marriages. Whereas in the non-college educated, which is the majority of America, the middle class and the working class, what you have is marriage quickly disappearing, far fewer people getting married, far more children born to single mothers, and a divorce rate as high as it was in the 70s. And I think that's largely because as women rise, they have certain expectations for what they want from a spouse, and the men aren't meeting those expectations. So in the book, you meet several couples who are in this situation, and you really get to hear the women and the men talking about what this changed circumstance is like and what it's done to their lives.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to the phones now. We'll speak with Alan in Plano. Hi, Alan.
Hi, Chris. Thank you. Ms. Hosen, I read about your book this morning in a column in the New York Times by David Brooks.
Yes.
And I was fascinated by it, and I just thought it was marvelous to see the changing sociology of our nation and the rise of women to what I think is long overdue. Just two comments. I have a 34-year-old son who feels completely at ease with his fiance making more money than he does. They live in Portland, Oregon. And my wife and I also have a 29-year-old daughter who lives in Austin, and she is providing the main support right now. Her fiance has graduated from college, but he's gone on to nursing school. And in both instances, I see my children behaving much differently than my wife and I did. I'm 64, my wife's 59. But I'm so happy to see that women are being recognized. And I wonder if you see anything in terms of the political world wherein women are able to discern that, hey, we have a lot to offer in politics as well. And we have a lot to offer in terms of the way we see issues that may be less bellicose and more conducive to getting along with one another. Thank you very much, and it was a pleasure to be able to chat with you today.
Thanks for your call, Alan. What do you think about all that, Hannah?
I'm happy to hear it. I'm happy to hear that he's not horrified by it. I mean, I think that's great, you know. I mean, we haven't talked to the other partners in either of those relationships, so you don't know how they feel, but it seems like that's the way the world is heading, and the more that we are comfortable with it, the better. It's not threatening, really. There's no reason it should be threatening. In some way, it eases the burden on men. You know, there are periods in history, in American history especially, where being the breadwinner has felt like a noose for men, you know, something they're forced to do, and I write about that history as well. And then there are ways in which women who are now doing everything are feeling exhausted and strained and like, how can they possibly keep up? So I think if we loosen up a little bit on the roles, we'd be in a much better place.
Let's talk about this. The idea used to be that if the man was out earning the bread for the family, then the woman's job was to take care of everything at home. We know that women are still doing more than their male partners in terms of housework and childcare, but the numbers are getting closer every year.
They're slowly getting closer. That's true. And every time I see them, I cheer. I mean, it is culturally true that being a father in the way that your father was a father is not that culturally acceptable in many places. You know, men, you know, fatherhood has changed. Men are expected to be involved in their children's lives. I think largely they are. It's a question of how much time is put in. And I think, you know, men are getting there. I mean, also in these surveys, one thing I realized in doing this research is we often tend to define housework as like laundry, you know, cleaning up, cooking, and you forget that men do a lot of things around the house, you know, like fixing things, or, you know, fixing the computer is never on those lists of housework.
Although right.
If you think about it, that's housework. And so there's lots of ways in which men and women can contribute in the ways they like to contribute, and it become more equal.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Christopher on the line now in Denton. Hi, Christopher.
Why, hello. It's a pleasure to speak with you.
Welcome.
I'm a big fan of the show, big fan of Hannah. I'm a senior-level biology major at UNT, about to graduate, thinking about a medical field. I'm involved with our campus feminist organization and have been for years, and I find this all very interesting. For a long time, I've thought that men need a corollary to feminism, maybe to help them transition with this changing economy, much like the women's movement was there for the last several decades. Unfortunately, when I searched, all I could find were things called MRAs or men's rights organizations, and I found them very disappointing. They seemed a little bitter and not really contributing anything constructive to helping men out with this. My question for Hannah is there anything out there in the future that could fill that gap? And thank you very much. Big fan of the show.
Thanks for your call.
This is a critical amend for me and everybody who writes about these issues. There are not men's movements the way there are women's movements. I'm not sure that's ever going to change. There's something about, something seems to be strong in men that don't want to need anything or
sort of collect in that way. There was the Promise Keepers movement, an evangelical movement at one point, which ran very strong, which was about men and feeling their sensitivity. There's certainly been sort of bursts here and there, but not the same as the women's movement. And you're right, the men's rights movement, you know, different people have different reactions to that or might be alienated by it. But what men are looking for is sort of a more broad movement that talks about, say, paternity or, you know, paternity leave or, you know, unions or things that might help men. And that doesn't ever seem to come together. In my mind, the way this change happens is, you know, house to house. It's like we all have a mother. Many of us have wives and girlfriends or sisters. And so you see these changes happening under your very own roof, and you are forced to respond to them.
Does the term feminism mean something different in 2012 than it meant in 1975?
It sure does, just because a lot more people are reluctant to take it on. But what I see broadly and what you see in the characters in my book is that, you know, again, they are doing things which the rest of us might see as feminist, you know, taking on new roles, supporting their family. But it's just something they're doing. They don't think of it as being part of a movement. They just think of it as taking advantage of an opportunity that's sitting there before them. So are they feminists or not? I mean, I would say they're feminists, you know, but they wouldn't say they're feminists. So it's just a difference of opinion.
What do you think accounts for the really extraordinary gains in women's, not just grades, but academic achievement and degrees and things like that, that are really quickly outstripping those of men?
That's amazing because that's true all over the world.
Yeah.
I mean, that's true in almost every country, every continent. And so there must be some way in which women are better suited to what it is that school demands. And it's perfectly possible that that's been true for a century. I mean, I think, you know, in the early part of the century when the high school movement started, women were graduating from high school at higher rates than men. But I don't think it mattered as much. You know, people never thought that, you know, there were limits to how women could go far in the workforce. So the fact that they were able to sit still and focus and concentrate and make it through school was, you know, lovely, but wasn't that critical. Whereas now it's become really critical because it's really not about intelligence. There's no measurement that says women are more intelligent than men. It's these external things outside of intelligence. You know, sit still, focus, follow through, organize yourself. And, you know, as we all know, we live in a society that demands more and moves at a faster pace. And so women are, you know, women can keep up with that. I don't know why, but they just can.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Milton is on the line next from Fort Worth. Hi, Milton.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
First, I find it interesting that it's several men who've been on the phone and on the third one. Anyway, I am in a profession that when I started was 97% women. And that was in the early 70s. And I found it, I love my profession, and I retired after 30 years.
Do you mind if I ask what you do, Milton?
Occupational therapy.
Okay.
And so for the first 15 or 20 years, I had nothing but women bosses and nothing but working with women. Very seldom did I ever run into a male. And I didn't know it was 97% profession when I got in. I was just one of the veterans coming out, and it looked like a great profession. Anyway, it's been wonderful. The thing that I noted, though, was both in school and all the way through up until a few years ago that being so heavily oriented towards women, that there was a form of reverse discrimination, and it was still a wonderful profession, but in terms of job advancement and other such things. I went into private practice early on, so I didn't notice that to a great deal. But my question is if there's anything that is being done or is part of this process that allows women to note men in the process of change in getting into women's professions.
Thanks for your call. What do you think, Hannah?
Can you remind me, what profession did he say he was in?
Occupational therapy.
Occupational therapy. Okay, yes, that is a largely female profession. I had the thought when I was reporting in some of these towns and saw the women in charge of the hospitals, for example, when I asked them, would you ever hire a man for a nurse or receptionist? And they laughed, you know, because it just seemed like such an unmacho thing. And then it occurred to me that there could be one day when the women control so many of the available jobs and they shut the men out of those jobs just because because of our old stereotypes and understandings about, you know, what kind of a job a man should do. Because I think the man is absolutely right. It's not just like men are limited and they can't move forward. It's a kind of larger social expectation and reaction that we have. So I write in the book about seeing a stay-at-home dad in my own community was doing a project, a sort of handprint project for the teachers in my preschool, and I was like startled by that. You know, I have one child who's much younger than my other children, so it'd been a while since I was in preschool. And then over the course of researching the book, I really tried to question myself on why did I find that startling? You know, given all that I've researched, I should be applauding and welcoming that. And yet, you know, there's something visceral that we need to work hard to get over.
For a long time, Hannah, women said if we ran the world, there would be no wars, we would be very peaceful, we would all get along. And yet, you know, we've had now three female secretaries of state in this country. We have not necessarily shied away from conflict. And there has been the notation that when women achieve positions of great power, they don't necessarily act especially different from their male counterparts.
Yes. I mean, I resist that idea. I think it's slightly condescending to say that, you know, women are nicer and they create peace and are more peaceful. I mean, that's true to some extent. And studies have shown that women make decisions in a different way, but not in a nicer, more peaceful way. So, for example, they tend to take more people's opinions into account. They're more collaborative. I'm not saying they will be forever. I'm just saying when people look at, you know, decision-making models, so that's one thing that women do. They tend to be a little more long-term and cautious, so they don't make decisions very quickly. When they look at how many trades, for example, a single woman versus a single man working on Wall Street makes, the single man makes four times as many trades as the single woman. But it turns out that that wasn't necessarily a good thing for the bottom line, you know? So is the woman nicer? I don't know. She's just, you know, she's thinking in a slightly different way. But I do think that, that's why I put in my chapter on violence, is because I want to resist this idea that women are, you know, not as aggressive, can't be dominant, that they're always peacemakers. And, you know, I think power has an effect on women the same way it has an effect on men.
Hannah Rosin is with us. She's senior editor at The Atlantic and a founder of Slate's women's section, Double X. She's got a new book out called The End of Men and the Rise of Women. We'll come back to the conversation with more of your calls and emails in a couple of minutes. The email address is think@kera.org, and the phone number is 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can study a variety of topics such as creative writing, human rights, and the arts. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Hannah Rosin. We're talking about her new book, The End of Men and the Rise of Women. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. The email address is think@kera.org. So, Hannah, American women now hold a slight majority of the professional and managerial jobs in this country. We get more education. On the other hand, we are a very small minority of Fortune 500 CEOs, and we're like 16-17% of Congress.
Yes, the picture at the very top looks very different, and also the ultra-rich are primarily male. So it seems like only a matter of time. It seems completely unsustainable. Given the rest of the trends right underneath that, there's no real reason why that should be true. But in the book, what I talk about is why that is. I mean, why are we uncomfortable with female power? Why haven't we reached those top levels, and what can women do to get there, and like very specifically what they can do to get there in terms of how to present themselves in the workforce and sort of where the challenges are. And, you know, not to put it all on women, I would say our workforce makes it sort of difficult because in the U.S., And part of the reason I wrote this book is to make people acknowledge that women are so important to the economy, because we still have a workforce that acts as if somebody is always at home with the children. I mean, we are not at all equipped to handle the fact that two parents in the family work. So we're the only industrialized country without maternity leave. I mean, there's a lot of ways in which we make it very difficult for women when they reach their, you know, mid-careers or would be just about to hit the peak of their careers, make it difficult for them to do that if they want to.
Well, you know, when you, it also comes back to that idea of the amount of education people have and the kinds of relationships they have, because for me, I can speak for myself, and I would imagine for you, it's a little bit easier to be flexible than someone who has a sort of a hourly job on the floor of a store selling things.
Right. Well, that's why you see that things are changing unevenly. So even at the top, you see some professions changing rapidly, like all of a sudden, you know, the heads of the major Ivy League universities are women. You know, that kind of happened overnight. But then you have finance, which is very resistant to change, and you have law firms, you know, which are used to operating on an hourly fees, are, you know, trying to think about ways in which they can hang on to these women who are coming through law school at a greater rate than men, but you know, seem to drop out at a certain point. And then you have some professions which are shifting very rapidly, like within the medical professions, there are special, you know, there are specialties here and there which are becoming rapidly female. So it really almost always has to do with how much a woman can have control over her own time. That seems to be the key to whether a profession, you know, becomes amenable and open to women or not. So that's all going to happen slowly. For example, in Silicon Valley, where I interviewed a lot of the women, they work so hard you wouldn't believe it, but they do also work flexibly. So they, because they're not a fixed old guard workplace, they kind of made up the rules as they went along. And so, you know, you'd hear women making requests like, can I leave at 5:30 and, you know, put my kids to bed and then go back online at night? And that was fine. And they kind of work out individual arrangements that make it possible for a woman, if she wants to be extremely ambitious and still be present in her household as a parent. So I think to look at these new models that I write about is very important.
You write about Marissa Meyer in the book, and she's such an interesting story.
Yes, I love the story of Marissa Meyer. I feel no desire to have kind of a mommy war about whether she's making a good decision. I mean, you know, I'm 11 years into parenting. You know, I have my own personal opinions about how I wanted to raise my children. But I think it's amazing that somebody would get a job as the CEO in such a big and prominent company while visibly pregnant. And I also think it's great that she said that she doesn't want to take maternity leave. I mean, lots of women probably, you know, that's not the majority opinion. Most women would like to take maternity leave. But for somebody who doesn't want to, you know, she has a husband. I'm sure she can afford care. That's not going to determine whether she's a good mother or a bad mother. She wants to keep running this company. And I think the more models we have like that, the better it is. Not because every woman's going to want to do that or because it sets an unrealistic standard, which it does, but because some women will want to do that and it should be socially acceptable, and those are the kinds of women who will become the future presidents, right? So we need to have that in place.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Marie on the line next in Frisco. Hi, Marie.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was calling because when I was in college and graduate school, you know, I've got all those degrees you're talking about. I was all gung-ho. I was raised to be a feminist. I was raised to go forward, have the career, have it all. Then I became a mom, and all of a sudden I wanted to take a step back, and I want to stay home. I am shocked that this is what has happened. I never saw myself wanting this, but now that I'm in the throes of motherhood, sometimes I wonder if a traditional role isn't better for me, and I don't want to take women backwards, but I wish that there were more choices instead of feeling like, well, I have all these degrees, so I have to do and go forward like I was planning. I'd like to take a little step back. That's Hannah, where I'm at right now.
Thanks for your call. Hannah, what do you think?
I have two thoughts about that. One is I think that we should consider that completely normal. It should be utterly the expected that a woman and a man for that, you know, for that matter, have children and would like to step back a little bit. That should be built into the workforce. It should not be considered a sign that she's less ambitious or doesn't care about her work. It should just be considered a sign that she's a normal human being who has a child and wants to spend some time with that child. And we can build that into the workforce the way many other countries have. And the other thing I would say about that, and this is something Sheryl Sandberg, the CEO of Facebook, says, is that, you know, for some women, you know, she always says it's important for them to push through so that they can, you know, change the policies at the top, as she says about herself. I want to push through for myself even when it's very, very, very hard for me, because she also has small children, because I would like to make it possible for the women beneath me at Facebook to be able to have better maternity leave and get more understanding from their company. So I think both of those are true. Like, you want to be one kind of woman who's going to push through and, you know, be ambitious that way, like the women in Silicon Valley, great, but you should also be able to have a space and not have it be so agonizing, you know, am I completely giving up my career, or, you know, am I being a good mother to my children? It's like, human beings have children, women have children, and women work. I don't understand why that has to come as a big shock to both the workforce and every woman who goes through it. It should just be expected by both the workforce and the woman herself.
Is it inherently unfair, Hannah, though, that we many of us would like for women to have a choice one way or another to work or to stay home with their children? Not that those two things are mutually exclusive, as I think lots of mothers have proven, but we've never really given men that choice.
No, we don't give men that choice, and that's a real problem. I mean, when I see a story like Marissa Mayer's, all I'm thinking is, like, call up her husband. You know, why don't you figure out what her husband is doing? You know, maybe he wants to stay home with the kid. It just, it seems like that, you know, I don't understand how we can keep that blind spot open for this long, you know, when women are so ambitious. You know, we're starting, just now I'm noticing in the movies and in TV, we're starting to open a space where we have, you know, domesticated dads, men taking care of their children, and that's just kind of routine and even, like, appealing and attractive. Like, we're starting to create those role models, but just recently.
Well, let's talk about the depiction of men lately in TV and movies. And you know, there's, like, the 40-year-old virgin and all the Judd Apatow movies, and there's lots of ways that we show men to be not so together in ways that I don't think necessarily reflects the men that I know.
Yes. I mean, that's a phase that we went through, I think, in the 2000s, where men were slackers and the omega males, and they really didn't know what they were doing with their wives, with their lives, excuse me. And then they needed a wife, is what I wanted to say, or a girl to kind of, you know, who was rather shrill, always in the early Judd Apatow movies, was like shrill and bossy and had to tell them what to do. And, you know, you didn't know which character you wanted to be. Like, the man was more lovable, but also dysfunctional, and the woman was more together but usually unappealing. And so those were the two archetypes that were served to us over the last 10 years. And I think even now, you know, we're moving into a different phase where you have these, you know, strong and unlikable women. Like, if you think of Katniss Everdeen in The Hunger Games, mm-hmm. is one I'm thinking about, where, you know, you have a woman who's the hero of the story, heroine of the story. She's in the protector role. She's the provider, you know, and she's unpleasant. You know, she's not that nice. Whereas the boy who's attached to her, PETA, is kind of more collaborative and kind and knows how to play up the crowd. So it's like we're playing around with these different archetypes and seeing, you know, how much we can absorb of them now. And so hopefully what will emerge from that is sort of a little relaxation around the expected roles.
It is interesting, though, and my kids are really obsessed with The Hunger Games, but it absolutely turns upside down the waiting for the handsome prince to save you. In fact, it's the guy who is saved by the strong woman. And I don't think for the generation of sort of teenagers and below that exists now, that doesn't necessarily strike them as unusual or something to be even commented upon.
Exactly. They don't notice it. I mean, in my generation, it would have been like, you know, a big deal, like in Free to Be You and Me, and you have to be like, William wants a doll,
you understand? Right.
Like, he wants the doll. Do you see what I'm saying? You know, it was all very sort of explicit and in your face. And I don't think that, you know, I have an 11-year-old daughter. She and her friends don't talk about this in, like, you know, girl terms or princess terms. It just is. Like, they didn't occur to them that there's anything unusual about the fact that Katniss is how she is and PETA is how he is. It's just the way it is.
Let's go back to the phones now. We have Karen on the line in Irving. Hi, Karen.
Hi. I'm hoping to introduce a little reframing, a little context first. I'm a Vietnam-era veteran. I was one of the first 12 women to sell cars for General Motors. And I was a regional sales manager for menswear, which was a first. This past Labor Day and this last Friday, when temperatures were 105 in Texas, I took to the street with bottles of cold water to bring water to guys, to people who were working out in the streets. It's was such a profoundly moving experience that I wanted to add it to the conversation in your description of what men are trying to communicate when they refer to manly work, in which I bore witness to what that means. It seemed to me it represents a man's willingness to endure profound suffering on a daily basis for the sake of their family, for the sake of their wives and children. And the difference between being a nurse, as they would see it, and being out on a street with a sledgehammer, busting cement in 105 degrees, as I witnessed, is the willingness to endure profound suffering for the sake of their families.
What do you think about that, Hannah?
I do think that, I mean, I'm curious about the term suffering. There must be pride in that suffering. There must be other things in physical labor. I think it's incredibly important that we do not value brawn and physical labor, that we don't just say to men, you have to be women now, you know, that all the things that you take pride in and that make up your identity are devalued and passé. I think that's a very dangerous message to send to men and will only make them rageful. So the middle ground is to find, you know, some way to preserve brawn and the importance of it, but bring it into the new economy. So in the men that I reported and wrote about, you know, they did things like high-tech manufacturing is one thing that people are trying to do at the aftermath of the manufacturing economy, which requires some training and technical learning, but is still, you know, manufacturing work. Or artisan manufacturing is another thing that economists talk about, where you take your specialized skills and you bring, you know, to build things, and you use that instead of just traditional manufacturing. So I think that's really important. You can't take away from men everything that's defined them and all the virtues that they've been associated with, and then just tell them they have to be women. I mean, that would be like what happened to women in the 80s when, you know, it was like, you got to wear a pantsuit and you got to be really tough. And, you know, that wasn't right for us either, I think. So there's no reason we should think it would be right for men.
I mean, do you think this is a pendulum issue and that eventually we will swing to where we're pretty much centered?
I think it is a pendulum issue. I don't know how long it's going to take, but we do have a long sort of swing arc to go. I mean, I don't think we're quite close to being sort of in the same place, but I do think it's a pendulum issue, because I think men will become more flexible the longer they're down, and I think women will become less extreme. I mean, you know, if we take sort of the sexual arena, you see, I write about this too in my hookup chapter, you see a lot of women kind of trash talking. I mean, I do that on purpose. I'm kind of putting in your face sort of the extreme version of this, you know, women talking in certain ways and, you know, being really raunchy. The new movie Bachelorette has another version of this, which came out this week, and it shows women behaving in kind of unlikable, raunchy, crude, reckless ways. And I don't think that's where we'll end up, but I think it's a phase that we need to go through.
Hannah Rosin is senior editor at The Atlantic and a founder of Slate's women's section XX. Her new book is called The End of Men and the Rise of Women. Hannah, it's been a fascinating discussion. Thank you so much for giving us this hour.
Thank you for giving me so much time.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is senior producer. You can learn more about the show, find out about what we've got planned coming in the future, and download the free daily podcast at kera.org/think. Email comments, questions, and suggestions to us at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.